Our next speaker is Laura Punnett, and Laura is a occupational epidemiologist and ergonomist and a PI of the NIOSH-funded Center for Excellence to Promote a Healthier Workforce, the Center for the Promotion of Health in the New England Workplace. And then we are deeply committed to an employee-centered participatory approach to health promotion that borrows heavily from the literature on participatory ergonomics and that examines the organizational conditions of work affecting individuals' health behavior. So without further ado, go ahead, Laura.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be part of this session, which is on a series of very important topics. Mine is actually sort of goes back to Chrissy's discussion about patient handling and health effects for healthcare workers, but in this case, nursing home rather than hospital, and we have no relationships to disclose. So we've been partnering with a large privately owned company, which until a few months ago owned more than 200 skilled nursing facilities. They've just doubled in size, but this is the scope of what we've been examining. And they, in 2004, began to implement a safe resident handling program in all of their facilities, which we then had the opportunity to come in and evaluate. So we weren't involved in the design of the program. As you can see, it was actually a fairly comprehensive program. A lot of issues that sometimes sink these kinds of programs were thought through, and equipment was purchased for each facility by the central office, by the corporate level budget cost center, based on the needs of the residents who were then in each center. And you have some idea, I'm sure, already of what kinds of equipment we're talking about. So both total body lifts, sit-stand lifts, and also smaller items like slide boards were included in this program. So we've published a series of articles on this work. Alicia Karowski, who's sitting back here, has shown quite comprehensively the reductions in ergonomic exposures among CNAs, among nursing assistants, in a sample of these nursing homes with the implementation of this program and the availability of lift devices. We've also, in a separate paper, shown reductions in compensation claim rates and costs, and also in turnover rates in clinical staff, probably not all attributable to this program, but nevertheless coinciding with this program. So some of my friends have said to me, just leave well enough alone, but I never do. And also, of course, we have concerns about compensation as an outcome measure, compensation claims, and the probability of underreporting. So we also have wanted to take advantage of survey data to look at whether there was a reduction in the occurrence of low back pain in these workers, concurrent with and consistent with the reductions in exposures and in compensation claims. So we've distributed surveys in the first 5 years of the project. We distributed surveys in 18 nursing homes covering all direct care workers. We started at what we called baseline, which is the week that the program was kind of rolled out in each nursing home, and then with the follow-up intervals that you can see here, we returned with essentially the same questionnaire, although adding some items specific to the Safe Resident Handling Program in the follow-up surveys. And the key outcome that I'm talking about today is about, obviously, low back pain, and we've looked at a couple of different case definitions of this outcome. And then we have a wide variety of other variables to bring into the models, demographics and work environment factors. As I said, specific features of the Safe Resident Handling Program and the follow-up surveys. And the statistical analysis is actually a little more complicated than one would have hoped, because in an ideal world, we would have been able to survey twice before the program was implemented, so we would have had an estimate of incidence rates within people before the program began, and we could compare that to incidence rates after. But actually, the program was implemented so quickly. Usually these things, you know, lag behind whatever the desired schedule is, but actually it rolled out so quickly that we had to scramble to get in for single baseline surveys at the at the implementation in the implementation period. So we only have prevalence data from before the program began, and therefore we have to do these kind of more complicated models to look at changes in prevalence in a rigorous way after the implementation. And because we have repeated measures, because we have people who show up in multiple surveys, that causes another level of complication in how the models are fit. And we've looked at clustering on person and on center, that is individual workplace, and also on region, because these data come from both the Maryland and from Maine, the data that I'm reporting here. So, so you can ask me about the statistics if you want to know later. So we've gotten pretty good response rates in each survey over time. Of course, the population is primarily female. You can see the demographics here. We have worked hard to get good responses on all shifts. We have only employees of the company, not agency staff, but they can be temp or ad hoc scheduling, so they aren't all on regular shifts. And for these analyses, I've taken out just the workers who were in the baseline survey and then also resurveyed on at least one of the follow-up occasions so that we could actually take account of individual characteristics. And it's a population that has that had a crude prevalence, as you can see, of low back pain of about 30% at baseline. So I mentioned about the two regions. So the black line shows the data from Maryland, which has roughly the pattern that we had hoped for, which is a something of a decrease, but not a very impressive one, but something of a decrease from the baseline survey, which is zero on the x-axis, coming out to 24 months here. The data from Maine show a very different picture, and this is complicated by kind of organizational issues. So the centers in Maine were purchased and then immediately implemented the program. So the purchasing of these centers involved all sorts of administrative changes because they went from one ownership to another. At the same time, the state of Maine was changing its regulatory enforcement procedures. So we knew in our visits, we observed anecdotally, people were very stressed out by a lot of different things. You know, change at the top can cause a tremendous amount of anxiety for people. And actually, in addition, interestingly enough, some of these centers already had lifting equipment in place, which they thought was better than what the company was bringing in this large across-the-board program. So I can't tell you which of those things is the cause, but you can see this red line, the symptom prevalence actually went up. Now, I've exaggerated a little bit because the y-axis doesn't go down to zero. The y-axis is just ranging from 20% prevalence to 40% prevalence. So the difference isn't quite so dramatic as it looks, but I just wanted to kind of make it really obvious that there was a pretty big difference between these regions, which is, of course, if you kind of pool all that and you draw a line through an imaginary line through the pooled points, you can see that there's really not much change in prevalence over time at all. So we did some multivariable modeling in GLIMIX to look at, to try to fit essentially that imaginary line through those data points that I was just asking you to picture, and it's basically a flat line. There's no evidence of a decline in symptom prevalence over time. And if we looked at clustering by center or clustering by region, none of those came out as statistically significant, which is a little surprising because region certainly looks like it's doing something here, but it didn't in the modeling. It didn't come out as a strong explanatory factor. So then we also, of course, were interested in occurrence of new cases because there are, I think, really two different issues when you're looking at prevalence. One is whether people who already had pain get better or not after the program is implemented, and the other is, are you preventing new cases, which at least we would hope that the program would achieve that. So this is the occurrence of the reporting of back pain in a subsequent survey, in a follow-up survey, divided by whether or not the individual said they had pain at baseline. So among those people who did not have pain at baseline, there was a 17%, you could think of it as incidence rate. Of course, these are episodic, but something like a 17% incidence rate of new low back pain in people who weren't previously reporting pain. So that's kind of our, that's sort of our incidence rate to track in future surveys. And among the people who did have low back pain at baseline, a very high proportion of them continued to have pain later on. So we're seeing quite a high persistence of back pain, and that's what's reflected in this odds ratio. That is, having back pain at baseline is a very strong predictor of having back pain in the future, which is not a new finding. Plenty of back pain studies have shown that before. So if you just focus on the part of the incidence of new cases, so the proportion of people at any one survey who didn't have pain and then do in the next survey, so those are the bars that I've circled in red here, you can see it's about 12 to 14%. On any, so sort of dividing it up over calendar time, taking that 17%, just dividing it up into these different survey occasions, it's really not changing very much. The incidence of new pain, quote unquote, is about 12, 13, 14%, and it's pretty static. It's not going down as we would have hoped to see. And the persistence of pain is also not showing any really dramatic decrease. It's starting at a little over 50%. It's close to 60% and then comes down back down to about 50%. So taking apart prevalence into its sort of two components, the occurrence of new pain and the persisting of previous pain, neither one of those really changed relative to the implementation of the program or in periods after that as the centers kind of learned how to run these programs more effectively. Compensation claim filing went down, but self-reported pain didn't. And again, with multivariable modeling of that persistence, very, very strong effect over time. So essentially kind of suggesting that once you have back pain, you don't get rid of it, even if there's some reduction in the biomechanical exposures over time. So that's pretty disappointing because we had certainly hoped to see a decrease in back pain. Very strong clustering of back pain within subjects. So if you have it in one survey, you're very, very likely to have it in a later survey. We have a list of other variables we can try adding to the models that we've fit, but so far none of them really make much of a difference. So the struggle then is this important to publish? Is there something to be learned from this? What's the right way to interpret these findings? Again, the persistence of back pain isn't a new finding, and those of you like me who've had back pain is probably not very surprising either. And of course, it kind of underscores our concern about the underreporting of back pain, the underfiling of compensation claims, which is certainly one possible explanation for the discrepancy here. But I wonder if people have other thoughts. I would really value hearing that feedback. So that's what I have to share with you today. Thank you very much.
Okay, we definitely have time for we have time for questions. So I guess I'll start on this side, David.
Yeah, we haven't gotten such good data on absenteeism from the company. I mean, what they've provided us is very hard to interpret because they have a system of pooling sickness absenteeism and other personal leave, so it's really not sensitive to the kinds of things that we would like to look at. We do have severity data. I mentioned two different case definitions, and we can also look at severity as a more continuous variable. So far that hasn't panned out, but that is, yeah. June?
In
That's correct. Yes. So the devices that were purchased were not the Cadillac absolutely best on the market at that time. But nevertheless, we have documented pretty impressive reductions in biomechanical loading on the workers who were doing resident handling. So they've had some impact on the basis of our own direct observations and analyses of those observations. But yes, that doesn't mean that better devices wouldn't have achieved greater reductions. And I'm sorry, your second question was training. Yes, so the training was about use of the devices. There was not a broader ergonomics training about what patient handling does to your back, why you should use the devices, how to troubleshoot your own jobs, thinking about the larger context of problems that can occur when the devices might not be useful. We've actually had a separate Susan Harwood grant to do some ergonomics training in some of these same centers, and there's definitely value added in terms of at least what the workers are telling us about additional information there. But the formal program is organized around training in the use of the devices and all clinical staff having to demonstrate competency in their use as a condition of employment, actually. Mary, Tish?
Is there time for a couple more?
Okay.
Either in either order. Right, and so 36% get better. Okay.
So, I mean, how does that rate in terms of what you've seen elsewhere? In terms of, I mean, it's not a bad thing, but maybe that's just a finding.
Right. That's a good question. I haven't done a quantitative comparison. I mean, back pain, it is episodic. I mean, in some of us, it lasts for long periods of time, and in others of us, it sort of comes and goes. So when you're doing a survey at intervals, it could be that somebody has back pain in one survey, and then in another one they say no, and then another one they say yes again. So, yes, but it's a good question, actually, to look at what magnitude of recovery is reported in other populations with high loading on the back. Thank you for that suggestion. Tish?
So I'm interested in your final comment about kind of underreporting, and it seems to me that underreporting would have to the rate of underreporting would have to change over time.
Right, right.
And one of the questions that we've had with implementing like a technological intervention is, does that increase reporting because workers now feel that there's new knowledge, new emphasis, there's new awareness, or does it decrease reporting because you now have a technological intervention and the worker feels they're more likely to be blamed if they haven't done it right?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think both of those are very plausible. We have heard, we've been in these centers, some of these centers many times over, repeatedly over several years, and including several centers where we were running focus groups and participatory teams for another arm of the study. And we did hear some things anecdotally about workers being told essentially, which is of course not legal, you can't file a claim now because we have this program in place. How big an impact that had, on the total reporting, I don't know. But if that surfaced in a few places, it's plausible to imagine that it was going on in a number of them. We actually gave that information to one of our liaisons who was very distressed and you know, supposedly sent the word back out that that wasn't allowed, but it's, you know, that's a hard thing to assess. And the other part of it, which also does happen often, that there's more reporting because attention is being given to a topic, that one, I don't know that we would hear about that from workers. You know, we might be less, because that's, if that's sort of an intrinsic thing, people might not think to say that to us. They might not be aware of it. So it's very hard, I agree, to tease out. But there is, it's not implausible to think that there is, over time, a differential reporting, you know, different factors acting on the reporting.
Okay, over here in the green.
How do you know that the equipment is being used and continues to be used? Because one possible story for differential reporting might be they've been given the equipment, it wasn't their choice, like we said, and they don't really like to use it. They revert back to traditional methods of communication. Get back to me. They feel exposed to it.
Right. So we've actually done another set of analyses looking at use of the self-reported use by individuals. And actually, it's interesting because about two-thirds of them say that they use the equipment most of the time or more often. And about a third are pretty honest in saying sometimes or less and reported a variety of reasons, including residents not liking the equipment and as well as, you know, not perceiving that they had a need for it or that they had enough time and other things that people have talked about. But the direct observations, at least in the same 2 or 3 years that are covered by these survey data, showed quite high rates of use of equipment in actual patient resident transfers. About two-thirds of the time that people were being moved out of bed or from chair to wheelchair or things like that, the equipment was being used. So it was pretty good. It wasn't perfect, but it was pretty good. It was pretty consistent with self-reports. Yeah.